At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you. When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat, and boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
Hey, everybody, it's Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
You see what I did there?
Well, no, I was actually looking at something because when I went, hey, your light flickered over there. It was actually really interesting.
Seriously?
I think there's a spook.
That is fascinating because we are doing a spooky special today.
Spooky special!
Spooky special! Because it's spooky season!
We are halfway to Halloween, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, we are like way more than halfway to Halloween.
Of the month of October.
Yes, of the month of October. But like in the grand scheme of things, we are like breathing down Halloween's neck in a very uncomfortable, very unsavory manner.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, ghosts.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm so psyched for this episode because I've been wanting to do like a spooky themed thing for the month of spooky season.
We have so much doom and gloom in our show.
We really do. I wanted to do something that was like,
this is not going to be doomy and gloomy, but a little bit spooky.
No, for all of you people that listen because you enjoy the doom and gloom as much as me and Devin do, there will be definite doom and gloom. But there's also just like kind of a paranormal spooky aspect to it. And I'm just like pretty.
And we're here for it.
Awesomely psyched about it.
We're here for it.
And we hope that you are too.
We, again, are committed to late night production.
Oh, hell yeah.
Making sure this comes out on time.
Mm-hmm.
Things have been adjusting for us lately.
We both have gone through some transitions, definitely more Devin than me.
We just spent like the last 10 minutes chit-chatting it up because I haven't seen you in 2 weeks.
I know, which is like unusual.
I mean, we talk all the time.
I don't love it.
But I haven't seen you.
Yeah. And the energy is different when we're in the same room.
Face-to-face versus phone-to-phone.
But we're one of those groups. We're one of those groups. We're one, me, you, and the spook that lives in the basement are one of those groups. And the safety hedge is also grabbing my hair. I feel like it's touching me, if you notice.
It's a spook.
It's the spooky season, baby. Me and Devin are one of those friendships that can just like walk in after not seeing each other for a while and just it's like continuing the conversation where we left
off. We were
off
picking up like, where we left off until I was like, hey, you realize I haven't seen you in 2 weeks?
Yeah, and I was like, no. Wait, what? Yeah?
Yeah.
Really?
Legit. Okay. Legit.
Yeah. So anyway.
New job's going well. I'm just not your coworker anymore. I am your co-host.
You are my co-host.
And your co-friend at life.
You're my co-pilot at life, if you will. And this one is actually special to me because I have started dipping my foot into mental health care recently in my professional life. So we're going to talk about a building that is
still standing.
Still standing. And it's actually called the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum.
It's actually called Lunatic in the title.
It is actually called Lunatic in the title.
Hmm.
And
who thought of that?
Devin.
DEI, come on.
Old humans were not were not good at the political correctness, okay?
Yeah.
And that leads me into the trigger warnings. And I actually put in here that some of the terminology used and some of the quotes I'm going to be saying from these old-timey people about this old-timey building, like lunatic asylum, for example, are archaic. They're somewhat ignorant. They are definitely not politically correct. They are not my word choices. No. They are just literally in the texts that I read and in the title of the building. So,
Shari.
Yeah.
No hate.
No hate.
All and love, no hate. In
trigger
season.
Warning. Yeah. And trigger warning, we're going to be talking about mental illness, like mental health crises, like people in mental health crisis. And there's children involved at one point. I will give you a little bit of a preface before that so that we can kind of give you a little bit of a warning. And you'll notice.
Oh, heads up, if you will.
Heads up, if you will. And you'll notice that we're going to talk about some of the themes and the pre-asylum era and like what brought that on. And it's going to echo one of our previous episodes that was a Devonism.
So
a fabulous one.
Oh, yeah. I did really good with that one.
You really did. That was our asylums and
lobotomies.
Yes. Asylums and lobotomies. So if you haven't heard that and you want to learn more about the history of like asylums and lobotomies in general, that's a really good listen. So go back. That's a good Devonism. One of the best Devonisms, if I do say so myself.
Woohoo.
So, starting back in like the pre-asylum era, early colonists arriving in North America brought beliefs from their old country when they arrived here. One of which was that people exhibiting aberrant behavior, which is like any behavior that's not considered normal social societal behavior, was considered to be possessed by demons or witches, and on occasion by the devil himself. So most everyone has heard of the notorious Salem witch trials of 1692.
I was just going to say this is triggering witch
trials
for me. Yes,
exactly. And in recent studies in the historical documents describing the symptoms of a lot of the accused, modern psychologists have actually concluded that the majority of the executed witches were most likely suffering from some kind of mental health issue or a medical issue. And other ones were punished just because their neighbor didn't like them and accused them of doing something that they didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole separate issue. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll do that one of these days, because there's a really interesting theory out there that the Salem witch trials was influenced by ergot poisoning, which is like a whole different thing. But so it's interesting. There's all sorts of interesting lore around that.
God, I love conspiracy theories.
God, I love history.
You could go down a rabbit hole.
Now, throughout the next century in colonial America, the treatment of these people was almost invariably barbaric. Like, there was no...
I know, isn't that... It's so awful.
It's...
treating them inhumane, so, like...
And when we say barbaric, it's like, they had no concept and no plan to help or deal with or keep safe people in this condition. Like, they just had no idea what to do. So if somebody had these behaviors or was exhibiting signs or symptoms and they did not have friends or family to look out for them and take responsibility for them and care for them, the only thing that society thought to do at the time was to put them in a prison, just
put
to
them
separate them from society. And they were in the company of common criminals, you know, violent people. Oftentimes, if these people were, you know, very severely like in mental health crisis and like self-harming or harming others, they would be just chained to the wall, unclothed, chained to the wall, regardless of temperature, covered in their own filth. Mm-hmm. Like, they were not cleaned. They were not fed. They were just like left chained to a wall because people just did not know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some families did take responsibility for their loved ones who were exhibiting signs or symptoms. But typically, they were more like afraid of what society would think of them and their family if society knew that they had a family member that was having this type of issue.
Right.
So a lot of it was like concealing.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know that they might have had a child or a sibling or something locked in one of those homes.
And they're just like forgotten family members, like the redheaded stepchild, which, you know, is a whole nother issue, which is incredibly sad.
Mm-hmm.
So people, I mean, would stash their family members away, like, in attics. Like, they would have, like, secret sheds, like, outhouses in the back. And they would just, like, keep their family member, their sick, ill family member who really needed help, which, of course, medicine had not advanced to even encompass what that means at the time. But this is what was done back in the day. And those people were just like completely extricated from society, and there was just nothing to do to help these people. And
thank God we've come so far.
Exactly. And I'm going to use the term insanity here because it's used in a number of the texts that I read to sort of, because that's what it was referred to back then. It was like you were normal or you were insane.
Mm-hmm.
And there was really no like in between.
I'm insane.
I could be. I'm insane. I have a mental health diagnosis. I'm insane, too. Throw me in a fucking hole in the ground. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so the term insane was used because insanity, meaning that umbrella term that covers literally everything except for sane, insanity is incurable. So had even tried.
Yeah.
Nobody had even tried. Nobody had researched. This was like the,
right off.
You know, insanity is incurable. Oh, once you have an episode like that, you're insane, you're incurable. You need to be extricated from society, either in a prison or have your family put you in a hole in the wall.
Could you imagine, like, I don't know why this particular one just came to my head, but like postpartum depression and stuff.
Well,
why did that just come into my head? But like someone who's completely.
Oh, no. You are absolutely right, because I will get into it. And as late as the 1930s and 40s, women were hospitalized and committed.
After having babies
or with other, quote, womanly dysmenorrhea, you know, like PMDD, like premenstrual dysphoric disorder, mood disorders from menopausal women who go through mood changes. I mean, when we get to that era, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but it is like, are you fucking kidding me?
Mm.
We'll talk about it.
Thanks.
Now, the 1800s brought a much needed change in the world of mental health care. At least it was the shadow of a positive thought about what can we do for these people, right?
A little glimmer.
Because what we talked about in the asylums and lobotomies episode was that, you know, this was a great thought. On paper, this was a wonderful thought, and the intent behind it was very honorable, because we were taking something that was very poorly understood, which was all of the mental health issues, and creating a facility in which these people, in theory, I'm stressing in theory, would be able to walk the halls freely, be fed, clothed, and cared for, be sanitary, get stimulating activities, socialize, and in theory have a great quality of life and maybe even re-enter society one day.
That was
These
the hope.
Were the hopes and the goals. It did not work out that way for a lot of years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people suffered and died as a result. Now, one of the pioneers of this idea and philosophy was Dorothea Dix. Do you remember reading about her?
Yes,
you did.
She was in that episode.
Yes. So she was the jack of all trades from Massachusetts, nurse, teacher, who said, you know what, we need to have places for these people. Mm-hmm. We cannot just keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that needs to be better understood. And we need to, and she started like lobbying in the state of Massachusetts, actually. She started like lobbying for change.
They're so progressive.
I know, right? And so she actually went and visited a prison in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and saw a mentally ill patient chained to a wall covered in their own filth. And she learned that this is just what is done with people that are suffering from mental illness. And she was appalled, and she was inspired to become like this lifelong crusader of improvement in the treatment of the mentally ill, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So once she started having some success with changing some of the legislature in Massachusetts, she started traveling state to state. She even traveled to Europe and Asia, and she ended up encountering Dr. Thomas Kirkbride. And Dr. Thomas Kirkbride was a physician who shared similar philosophies. His goal was eventually to become a surgeon, but he ended up sort of falling into psychology, and he developed something called the Kirkbride design or the Kirkbride method, which was a method after which many of the asylums were designed after him helping to design this facility. Essentially, it was a layout of a facility with all these different treatment rooms, all these different wings, and it was always like long corridors on either side in the shape of like a wide V with like a central tower. And he like was kind of like the architect behind all, not like, you know, not literally the architect, but like in spirit, the architect
behind the brains behind that.
The brains behind it, exactly. So she and him together worked to develop a lot of these asylums, open them, and theorize about, you know, what great work they could do. And so, essentially, the realization of his vision was moving patients from these overcrowded city jails and almshouses, essentially, where patients were often chained to the walls, and putting them in these, like, beautiful, ornate buildings with, like, nice furniture and nice grounds and gardens and, you know, fenced-in areas and walkways and hiking trails, and there were pets and there
a resort, a retreat,
someplace where you could get the rest you need and still socialize, walk freely,
feel human,
have some dignity as a human being. This is how it should be, and this is how it is in many facilities today. Not everywhere. It should be better everywhere, but this was the goal. There was a lot more pressure from lawmakers than once like these ideas came about to like execute this, because prison overcrowding is its own separate issue, right? Yeah. So they're like, hey, we love this idea. Let's offload these people that you know, our prisons are not equipped to deal with this either.
Right.
Let's offload them, get them specialized care, get them, you know, get prisons less crowded as well. So the age of the asylum had arrived.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
So, the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which is what it was called when it initially was opened, of course, that name actually has changed, but then I think they kind of reverted back to it when they started opening it and doing like haunted attraction stuff, just because it's like a, like the name is just like spookier, which it's, you know, shouldn't have that connotation, but like that is how it is. So was constructed between the years of 1858 and 1881. So this took 23 years to build in Weston, West Virginia, which is, it's like 2 hours outside of Pittsburgh, PA, or like 5 hours away from Washington, D.C. It is the largest hand-cut stonemasonry building in North America, still, to this day.
Wow.
It is.
That's going to be impressive.
Reportedly, it's actually the second largest in the world next to the Kremlin.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, it's sprawling, massive, and it is a beautiful building. If you see older pictures, I mean, it is gorgeous.
Look it up.
Yeah.
I haven't Googled
them. Okay, you Google it, Googleizer. So, like the Kirkbride, you know, method, there were these long, like, rambling wings, and there was this big, like, central tower. There was lots of sunlight. There was huge windows. The original hospital was designed to house 250 patients.
This thing almost looks like Buckingham Palace.
I shit you not. Almost. It's like this massive, beautiful,
gorgeous
place. Exactly. So the place was designed to hold 250 patients comfortably. And at its peak in the 1950s, in terms of census, 2,400 patients were held in there. 2,400 at once. As we know, most of these asylums that were created with good intentions ended up falling into a very negative place because of the massive demand for beds that was not met with even this massive influx of asylums being built and generated. And all of a sudden, it was like patients were starting to get shoved into rooms along with single patients that, like, these rooms were only built for single patients.
Right.
And they were housing 4 and 5 people in these tiny rooms with that were built for one patient.
Wow.
So
Something I'm seeing quickly here is like that they might let someone sleep in a bed or a cot for 8 hours.
Yes.
And then they might give their bed to somebody else. Like just rotate the same furniture.
Yeah, they would
furniture.
Just have to rotate the same furniture. And that was not just here. That was in many, that was the theme in many asylums.
These pictures are quite something.
I will say too, the Civil War was sort of in the throes of it around the time of the construction. And construction halted for a period of time. Because our armies needed to use the grounds, like the beginnings of the foundation and everything, and they actually converted it to what was known as Fort Tyler or Camp Tyler back in the day. And there was a battle at Fort Tyler, and there were soldiers that were killed on the grounds even before the place was constructed.
Got it.
So we'll come back to it, but there's actually, they say that people see like Civil War soldiers and like spooky stuff in the hall. So there's that. And so those who came to be treated for their mental health issues either voluntarily or were committed like involuntarily with the hopes that they would receive all that fresh air and rest and enriching activities. Unfortunately, the overcrowding and understaffing also became just like a hugely critical issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there were not enough staff members.
Funding.
The funding was an issue too. There were not enough staff members to manage this massive influx of patients safely. Some of these patients were violent to others or to themselves. And in order to keep things under control, patients were often kept in restraint for like days at a time. And as we know, early on, there were no real treatments available or medications for those suffering from mental illnesses, or there were very, very, very few. And again, I'm using quotations, insanity was considered incurable. So.
Right.
You know, that even like trying to help people was sort of very limited. Some treatments did begin to emerge like in the early 1900s. And I'm going to go through some of them here. Lobotomies, which we did discuss.
Yes, we've discussed.
And it's a procedure involving the use of an ice pick like tool, essentially, to sever the connective tissue in the brain's prefrontal cortex. And it, in theory, when it does work and is successful, can make patients more subdued and more like accepting of treatments, and it can control behavior of like very, very, you know, out of control patients. But a lot of, it was a very experimental procedure, especially early on. A lot of people died of brain, you know, having,
or they were left
having
as a vegetable,
or they were left completely in a vegetative state. I had really varying results. Shock therapy, in which electric currents are used to induce brain seizures in an attempt to treat mental illness, and it's actually used today.
I was
albeit
gonna say, that one's still,
it's still around,
rare,
and
but it's still there.
It's still used in it's in controlled you know, environments, thankfully, under like anesthesia and with like a whole medical team around you, and really it's used, you know, for like refractory depression and anxiety that is not responsive to traditional therapies.
Right.
And for some reason it works. We don't always understand it. Some of the other quote unquote therapies and treatments that they used there were hydrotherapy, which the name sounds nice, but patients were locked in tubs of water that were either dangerously hot or icy cold for extended periods of time.
And when we say extended, this is not the new rage of the ice bath things that people are doing
for two or three minutes. Like a,
this is like hypothermia inducing.
Oh, yeah. This is like for a long time. Like they would literally put this. There are photos of it. You can Google this, where there's an apparatus where the head pokes through and it holds the body under a tub of water.
Ugh.
There's something lovely called needle showers.
No.
I can't believe they called it a needle shower. Patients were sprayed with pressurized water that was 50 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 to 2 minutes to treat depression.
No.
Uh-huh.
No.
Needle showers. And then, of course, there is insulin shock therapy.
We talked about
which
this
we
one.
Talked
yeah.
about, which is when patients are injected with large doses of insulin just to induce comas, hoping that maybe they'd wake up and be better after being in an DKA coma.
Nope.
Or a hypoglycemic coma. And then, of course, Benjamin's up. And then, of course, forced sterilization. A controversial psychiatric treatment.
Awful.
Yeah, where they would literally just sterilize you.
We're going to just make sure that you can't make any other people like yourself.
Yeah, we want to end this with you.
Mm-hmm.
We want this to die with you. So that's disturbing. Mm-hmm. So again, while the vision was admirable, mm-hmm. and it was a nice thought on paper,
to try to help
executing
them,
it became a huge problem. Exactly. So this just essentially took this population of people and moved them from the prisons into their very own prison, mm-hmm. where it was essentially becoming hell on earth with the overcrowding.
Gosh, and, I don't even want to imagine.
And I mean, the sanitation was limited, right? The plumbing could not support.
I'm looking at are awful.
The plumbing could not support the amount of people that mm-hmm. were in these. And a lot of times the patients were just running the show in there mm-hmm. because they outnumbered staff members 10-1. Mm-hmm. How the hell were people supposed to be able to manage that safely? Mm-hmm. Staff mm-hmm. members got killed all the time. Security guards, nursing staff, physicians, providers got killed.
Wow.
By patients. Some of these people were violent. There were murders among mm-hmm. the patients. There were sexual assaults among the patients. There were physical assaults among the patients. Food became an issue. There was just not enough food to go around. People went days without eating. Rations had to be given. And I mean, many people's health just deteriorated while being there as a result of poor sanitary conditions, malnutrition, and then being physically assaulted here and there.
I wonder how the prisons that they all left, you know what I mean, to go to these places, they're probably just like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, exactly.
We have our room back. We can have more food. Yes. We can have, you know what I mean? Yes. Well, meanwhile, they're living in hell.
Meanwhile, they're literally, mm-hmm. and then society is just not acknowledging this. They're like, we have treatment plans now.
No.
Meanwhile, on the inside, mm-hmm. it's an actual nightmare. An actual nightmare. So let's talk about those who were committed to the asylum. So there were several medical conditions that were thought to fall under the whole quote unquote insanity umbrella term. Mm-hmm. These were people with substance abuse issues, addicts, people who were mm-hmm. alcoholics, soldiers sometimes with things like PTSD.
I was going to say PTSD, yeah.
Sometimes physical conditions like asthma, epilepsy, mm-hmm. you know, things that we didn't have a great explanation for and a great understanding of. Mm-hmm. Anything that we didn't understand
Insane.
For a time was labeled insane. Anything that changed your behavior, whether or not it was even a mental health issue, you're insane now.
Wow.
In the 1940s and 1950s, something that is less talked about at this time is the admission of women by their husbands. And this is where I'm going to get into that.
Yeah.
Some of the conditions written down in the guest book and like in the logs were, quote, menstrual derangement, imaginary female trouble. I have the next one. Imaginary female trouble.
Yeah, that's mine.
Imaginary female trouble.
That's mine.
That's mine.
I'm making it up.
And woman's trouble. These are mm-hmm. why women mm-hmm. are being committed by their husbands.
That's awful.
It was also not uncommon for husbands to admit their wives and commit them so that they could be with their mistress.
Fuck them. Oh.
I shit you not. Or just to try to cure them of, quote, womanly emotions.
Oh, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
The men were probably loving this up.
And then, of course, comes the postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the postpartum, I mean, and...
So a woman's got a bad case of PMS.
Uh-huh.
And then the husband's like, you're insane.
You better be careful because your husband might drop you off at the fucking insane asylum and not let you out.
Where's the imaginary male problems?
I want to know
people
what...
getting admitted into that.
So I want to know why, if my female trouble is imaginary, I'm being committed.
Because you're labeling it imaginary. Yeah. So you're insane.
It's not funny because this happened to real people.
Of course it is. It's just the absurdity.
It's so absurd mm-hmm. that I cannot wrap my head mm-hmm. around any of this. Mm-hmm. It's wild.
Head is not wrapped.
My head is not wrapping. I'm not commuting. Mm-hmm. I'm not computing right now. Unfortunately, patients with violent tendencies were sometimes locked in cages and put in rooms so that other patients crammed into the other room would not be harmed. But this wasn't always possible because there was just so much mm-hmm. volume. And then Walter Freeman, who we talked about.
Dr. Freeman.
Remember good old Dr. Freeman. We talked about him in the lobotomies episode, and he started performing lots of lobotomies at this facility to cure patients, quote unquote, throughout the hospital and hopefully make the violent people less violent and more manageable. But of course, this left patients disconnected from their emotions, and it seemed to make them docile. But on the other hand, it could kill someone, and it often did.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of hit or miss, to be honest.
He wasn't my fave.
Yeah, no.
Not at all.
Trigger warning. Oh, children. Here
we go. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Adults are not the only people that were treated in this asylum. There were many children that were quote unquote treated as well. The typical child that would be interned at the facility would be ranging anywhere from a child with some hyperactive tendencies, perhaps children that were on the spectrum to some degree,
right,
or children that were profoundly mentally disabled. So, I mean, anywhere sort of on that spectrum. There were even children that resided at the facility because they were born there women were admitted when they were pregnant at the facility and then delivered.
Or assaulted.
Or they were assaulted or engaged in sexual activity in the facility and then had their baby at the facility. So these kids, these young children, these babies are just growing up in this crap.
Yeah.
In this shithole.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them died.
I was going to say environment, but you chose a much better word.
Yeah. And so a lot of these kids did not survive.
How could you?
How could you? No. I mean, you have no real, like, great parental figures, you know, nope, for one. And then, like, the environment is secondary to that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And plus, there's all these freaking violent people around, you know?
And you're defenseless.
And you're defenseless. And these people are not getting the treatment that they need. Nobody is. In the mid-1930s, the facility was so overrun that it would be, again, 4 to 5 patients housed in rooms that could really only comfortably accommodate one. And they often didn't have heat in the building, and everybody was freezing cold. Patients and society members with a variety of issues grossly outnumbered the staff and, again, essentially ran the place. So violence was commonplace. Murder was commonplace. Sexual assault was commonplace. Food was becoming scarce. Sanitation was a big problem. Ventilation was a big problem. Hell on earth, like
mm-hmm,
I said.
Mm-hmm.
This went on for literal decades.
Yep.
And this was by far not the only facility that this happened in. So this was like a thing that just happened.
So many.
Yes.
So many facilities.
Yes, absolutely. This was countrywide, continent-wide, worldwide. Like this was mm-hmm, the norm
mm-hmm,
throughout the early 1900s. Thousands and perhaps millions died of botched procedures, violence, malnutrition, and unsanitary conditions worldwide around mm-hmm, this time. So the building itself, again, is sprawling. It's huge. And it's gorgeous. There are gardens. There's stone-paved walkways. There's that nice ornate tower in the middle there. And over the years, they did expand to try to accommodate all of that volume, but they had really no funding. Like, the states were not giving these places any funding.
Nope.
These places were just not on anybody's radar.
Correct.
For the longest time, which mm-hmm, is how people suffered for as long as they did. So they never were able to keep up with the over-occupancy. There was a period in the 1970s in which the asylum was also on record as having been used as a place where intoxicated people would get thrown into until they sobered up.
Oh, good. So it's the drunk tank.
Yep. So this would include teenagers who were out partying. Police would just toss them in there just to dry up. Unfortunately, like, these teens and young adults would be thrown in with men and women who were suffering from mental illness that was untreated or treated very much to a limited extent. All of them were hungry, and all of their issues were probably exacerbated by living how they were living. And a lot of these people were violent. And at least one young person was on record to have died because they were in there, had drank some alcohol. They were drunk. They were thrown into this asylum, and somebody stabbed them to death, a teenager.
Wow.
The abuse and neglect of patients inside the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum remained largely unknown to the public until, like, 1949. 1949 was when the Charleston Gazette published this big expose on the terrifying conditions. And this happened a few times over the next few decades. And out of these continued reports is where, like, the big period of reform came
mm-hmm,
in the 1970s mm-hmm, and 80s. some based like in the 70s and 80s, there was that big period of reform. And there was some clarification on legislation around this time that came out. The people who were deemed able to had the right to refuse treatment. And you could not just bring your wife in one day and be like, she's having woman troubles. Can you take her off my hands for a while?
Right.
You can't just do that to a person.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just bring a human being who is cognizant into a place and refuse to let them leave. You can't do that. So anyway, that was all reformed, thankfully.
Necessary.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this facility had been renamed a couple of times during its operation. It was renamed Weston State Hospital back in 1913, and then in 1990 was eventually made a National Historic Landmark. Ultimately, in 1994, it ceased operation completely. So it actually did operate as a mental health facility up until 1994. It operated for a total of 130 years.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
It's estimated that in total, approximately 30,000 deaths occurred there over the years within that building.
Goodness, 30,000
people.
So many.
And around 4,000 lobotomies were carried out in that place.
Remember the lobotomobile?
Yes. Yeah, the lobotomobile. Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes. The building
just
was...
Just do brain surgery in a van.
Yeah, just in a van. Mm-hmm. It's fine. So the building was a landmark and did give tours. And staff kind of kept things intact. And of course, time caused it to deteriorate physically. So they did try to keep it up. And when people were kind of, you know, the caregivers and staff members that were there keeping it up started reporting they were having experiences that they could not rationally explain. And in the following years, it has become known as one of the most haunted asylums known to us in North America. There are thousands whom likely died terrible deaths there, of course. And the hospital's better known spirits include a little girl named Lily, who was born in the asylum, a man named Jesse, who died of a heart attack in a bathtub, probably receiving hydrotherapy, and a patient named Jim James, who was brutally murdered by his roommates.
Mm.
And an article published by Marissa Cascino in the Washingtonian in 2018, that was titled, quote, "I spent the night in a haunted asylum and I still can't explain what I saw," end quote. Her article states, quote, "Julia and I set up in a room allegedly haunted by a spirit named Jim James. We placed a mag light on the floor and asked Jim to turn it on. The light was Julia's, but I inspected it and it seemed totally ordinary. A few beats passed and then it came on by itself. I offered Jim a cigarette to turn it back off. And it went dark," end quote. So, a little experience there.
I kind of want to go.
I kind of want to go. I'm not going to lie. So, and then in a room known as the back room.
No one wants to know what happens
in the back
room.
Nobody wants to know what happens. Oh, tell you. I'll tell you what happens in the back room. So this is a room towards the back end of one of the big long wings on the building. A patient was murdered by two other violent inmates there. This is graphic, trigger warning, because I'm going to describe what happened here. Apparently, they attempted to hang him, but when they failed, they placed his head under a bed frame and jumped on the bed frame until it touched the floor.
Oh.
That this is the stuff that happened in this place all of the time.
Oh my gosh.
There were many other patients that were murdered in cold blood by their peers just because of a combination of everything that happened, obviously. This room, the back room, is known for its cold spots. It's people can hear crying in this room often, I guess. And they hear like outcries and crying, and they say it's the ghost of a man named Dean who was murdered in this room.
Oh yeah. Man.
And the isolation cells is another hot spot. One story notes a former boxer who suffered from head injuries during his career that left him violent and emotionless, who was an inmate there. I'm assuming he had CTE. That makes sense. He attempted to beat down the metal door that isolated him, and he ended up ripping the door off its hinges, leaving visible dents in the steel. And when he finally got the door off, it is said that he handed it to one of the nurses and calmly returned to his room.
That's just boy.
A little tidbit about this boy. Guy. and the rooms there were mostly used for isolation to keep like the most violent patients away as they could. But visitors who visit there report being pushed, scratched. They hear disembodied voices saying, quote, get me out of here.
Get me out of here.
And similar types of things.
Get me out of here.
Yep, just like that. Good job, Devin.
My boys have a little Halloween book. You push a certain little button, it's a coffin, and it goes, get me out of here.
That's really weird.
That's why when you just said that, I'm like,
get me out of here. I was like, where is this inflection coming from? Because that sounds cheerful. I'm and gonna these people are not
go
cheerful.
Home when everybody's asleep, and that book's just going to turn on.
Yeah. And you're going to be like, oh, shit. It's my guy. It's CTE guy from the asylum. He's come to find me. There have been multiple paranormal investigative groups that have done investigations here using technology like REM pods, EVPs,
ghost hunters,
spirit boxes, EMF detectors, all of that good stuff to try and capture physical evidence of paranormal activity. I find this stuff so interesting because I don't know what, like, I'm generally very skeptical. So if there's like any possible explanation,
that's what
I'm going for. But I want to believe it so bad. I just find it so interesting that I'm like, I want to believe that that light bulb flickered because there's a spook in my basement. Right. I want to believe that. Rationally, I have not changed that light bulb since I lived here. So I know that it's the light bulb. I know that. But I want there to be a basement spook because that sounds kind of fun. I don't know. And back in 2009, at the pinnacle of his career, our buddy, Zach Bagans, and his infamous crew did a lockdown inside the building for an episode of the new age classic show, Ghost Adventures. Do you remember Ghost Adventures?
Barely,
oh
yes.
Oh my God.
I didn't watch it as much as you did, but
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So
I'm going to have to find this episode.
I recommend you do if you want to get a sense of like just what it's like walking in the halls and stuff. But take it for a grain of salt, please. It's a very theatrical show.
Of course, yes.
Stuff has come out that it was very much embellished and like there was not a lot of verity to whatever they were doing. They were doing a lot of it for showmanship. And I think a lot, that's a lot of his investigations. But he's just like so emo and like so intense, and the way he speaks and the way and like all, the theatrics of the whole thing is just very entertaining. Like, it's just entertaining. Like, it's fun. OK, just go watch it.
I'm going to find it.
It's fucking fun. It's entertaining AF. So they do catch a few EVPs, some footsteps, some noises, some clanging, lots of temperature changes, things like that. Nothing real striking, but I mean, watch it. It's fun. It's a fun watch. Nowadays, the building is owned by a sole proprietor by the name of Joe Jordan. It is being kept up and kept open for historical tours as well as ghost tours, and even offering extended ghost hunts, private ghost tours, and overnight ghost tours. Will you go with me? I want to go.
After we go to the Lizzie Borden house, okay?
I want to go to the asylum! So anyway, I mean, I want to go, but also, like, if I got in there, I would actively
shit
myself.
Yeah.
Shit myself. Absolutely. So, dark, dark history, very sad state of mental health care in the past, and, the now apparently very haunted happenings at the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in Weston, West Virginia.
So, it's spooky season. So, this is coming out tomorrow. Over the next 2 weeks until our next episode. I want to hear spooky stories.
Yes,
people,
please.
Email us your spooky stories.
We are getting ready for season 3's
wrap up,
which will include a break room banter, and we want some spooky stories. I've actually gotten a few, which I'm really psyched to share.
I would love,
but
some
I want
spooky.
More.
Yes.
If any of you have done like a ghost hunt or a ghost tour of some kind, I really want to hear about it. Like, tell me. I want to know. I want to know all about it.
I have like a psychic thing that was really near and dear to me that you know about, but so it makes me believe in a spiritual thing that's around for a loved one, but so now just random, can I just go somewhere, random Joe Schmo, spirits are coming out at me.
We want that. We want that. We
supposedly
want it.
There's a place in my town that is haunted too that lets you, like, I'll show you.
Oh, yes, you will show
me. It's right
me.
In the center of town.
Hold on. Let me grab my fucking EVP detector. And
yeah,
my...
where is that?
I don't. Like, I have one. I don't have any of that, but I might go buy some now because so I'm going to start ghost hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed, you know, just a little bit of a twist to just revisit some of the
something
the
a little different
some stuff.
Yeah.
And just get a little fun spook out of it, too.
You know, it's just 'tis the season.
Get me out of here. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Oh,
you can
God.
Search for us at Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube, Med Crimes Podcast.
Instagram by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
If you want to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
You can send us any of those crazy stories, spooky stories,
spooky
things that you want to tell us, because we are wrapping up season 3
Hell
in
yeah.
the next, like...
few episodes
in
man.
The next probably month-ish
mm-hmm.
month to two.
Gosh, it'll be hiatus
it? Yes.
time. We'll
so,
miss you guys,
but so season 3 will be wrapping up with a break room banter, so let's do it.
Let's freaking do it. Stay spooky out there.
Oh,
oh,
that's a twist.
I know.
Ciao.
Bye.